Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is
Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short.
Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
What up, what up, everybody? Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Michael Steele, yes. Everyone had a wonderful holiday, a wonderful Labor Day. We want to give thanks for the men and women who do labor on behalf of this great nation and our families and kind of keep us all going. So hopefully you had a chance to, you know, put a shrimp on a Barbie for a few of our men and women who are out there working and keeping us going strong. There's a lot to get into, and every once in a while, you want to take a step back and sort of digest it. And one of the things I always loved when I was working with my friend and partner, Rick Unger, was when we'd have these big moments and we could just step back and digest them. And we've got some huge ass moments that have occurred from the, you know, withdrawal from Afghanistan to the Texas abortion law to the California governor's recall, the anti-vaxxers on the right wing. There's just a lot. So I've always loved just sort of digesting, just sort of taking a moment and saying, how the hell did we get here? Why the hell are we still here? And how the hell do we get away from it? And my partner in crime for all of that has always been none other than Rick Unger, the host of The Rick Unger Show. You can catch him. He's nationally syndicated. 2-hour political and news commentary radio show. He is a progressive, at least on paper.
So, I get accused of that more and more lately.
But he's made his mark in radio and television because he's always been willing to mix it up. And we have always had fun mixing it up. Rick, welcome back to the podcast, buddy.
Always great to be here. I took an extra anti-acid pill knowing how much digesting that we were going to be doing today.
I think I probably should have because it's a crap load of it, my friend. It's a crap load of it. So let's just jump right in because there is is such a target-rich environment right now for discussion. But I feel a lot of Americans at least in some sense, kind of emote their way through this. And I really want us to kind of get to, particularly when we get into some of the later topics where there is the intersection of law and politics, for example, to really kind of break stuff down so folks understand it. Let's start off first and foremost with the events of August 31st, which was our last day in Afghanistan. The war that would never end, America's longest war, finally did end on the 31st of August when American soldiers pulled out of Afghanistan. And the evacuation of Afghanistan, which was, to be very polite about it, an effed up hot mess, has left an indelible mark on not just our withdrawal, Rick, but I think America's approach which really in many respects was symbolized by that withdrawal. It symbolized how we got in, it symbolized what we did over the last 20 years, and it certainly symbolized how we got out. What was your takeaway? How do you address that, particularly now we're seeing Americans digest this in a way that negatively, they want to get out, but they didn't like the way we did it. It's having an impact on the president's approval at the moment, along with a few other things. How are you assessing it?
Well, first of all, you show good insight with some of the things you said, like at the moment, because that's critical to understand. Look, I am one of those Americans. I divide it into two parts. I'm thrilled that we are no longer involved in this war. We should have been out, you know, being charitable 10 years ago. After Osama bin Laden was gone, after we had cleared out a lot of the rat's nest of terrorism that was being permitted to exist in that country, that's when we should have gone. We could have left and claimed victory, and away we go. That's not right. What we did. So I am very glad that that's over. The second part is obviously something very different. I was also one of those Democrats who was and remains very unhappy about the exit. Now, look, I mean, I understand what the administration is talking about when they say there really can't be a clean exit. And I think we've got some history that backs this up. Anybody who was alive during Vietnam remembers how ugly that exit was. And both of those wars had something in common. With Vietnam, it took 2 years for the South Vietnam government to fall. But it was all the result of that, quote, peace deal that was entered into in Paris by Henry Kissinger with the blessings of his boss, Richard Nixon, that was really nothing more than a surrender deal. Well, we saw the same thing here. We saw a, quote, peace deal being entered into the Taliban by the last administration, which was nothing more than a surrender. Yes, we couldn't extend it out a couple of years to lessen the blow a little bit better, as Nixon was able to do. But, you know, inevitably, Michael, when we get into these wars where we have no business being there, and arguably there was a better defense for the Vietnam War, because if you were one of those people who believed in the domino theory, remember the domino theory?
Oh, yeah.
if we let Vietnam fall to the communists, then all of those surrounding countries will fall with it. Well, you know, the North Vietnamese, who represented the communist push, they weren't giving in, so at least there was some rationale for still being there until it became clear what should have been clear from the start, which was we couldn't win that war. Here you don't even have that. So yeah, we need to be gone the way we exited. Maybe it was inevitable, but there are some things that are not inevitable.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah, no, your analysis is straight up, and even how you sort of frame it from the political perspective, certainly among Democrats. But here's my underlying problem, and I do appreciate the analogies back to Vietnam. I certainly appreciate that specifically how you put it in terms of, you know, trying to save face to get out.
Yeah.
So it raises for me a couple of things. One is our government so incompetent in such affairs that you say yes. That, I mean, when you look at Vietnam, you know, you get into a war that leading analysts at the time, and certainly even members inside both the Eisenhower and the Kennedy administrations were like, we really don't need to be here. We don't need to engage this way. At the end of the Eisenhower administration, and Kennedy sort of went all in. The same here with Afghanistan, the Bush administration, I get it. They harbored 9/11 thugs and murderers, and we wanted, you know, the price had to be paid for that. And I get that, going after Osama bin Laden, et cetera. But then at a certain point, and this is where the incompetency for me comes in, why can't you just say we did it? Now we're done. Let's get the hell out. I mean, you're not building. You're not building a democracy in the mountains of Afghanistan. I mean, it is a at its core. Does anybody understand the history of this place?
I can give you one word to answer your question: contractors.
Yeah, there it is. There it is.
The amount of money that was made during these past 20 years by defense contractors.
Yeah, I mean, it just, and the lives lost, yes. The treasure lost because of that. And then the second part for me, Rick, is where the Biden administration comes into play. You have a president who then, as vice president, had given his counsel to the then sitting president, Barack Obama, to get the hell out.
Yes.
And had gone on record that this war needed to end. We have no critical or legitimate reason to be there any longer. So get out. And yet and still between 2010 and 2021, you would have thought that this man, the current current president Biden, would have thought of a strategy to leave and would have done so, particularly given that he came in knowing that his predecessor had come up with a cockamamie plan to shut everything down. Because everybody, you know, these conservatives run around, you know, with their noses out of joint about Biden. They could not tell you what the Trump plan for exiting Afghanistan would be, because there was none. This was the man who wanted to invite the Taliban to Camp David to sit down and break bread and have whatever drink cocktails they were going to have and you know, kumbaya with the terrorist organization. Weekend,
I was like to throw that in.
What was that?
He wanted to do it over a 9/11 weekend.
Yeah, even more so, even more galling and insulting. So I don't understand why the Biden administration, and what's your assessment of from the folks inside and outside that bubble you may have talked to, why didn't they plan this better? How could they not have known what the CIA, NSA, and others were telling them were going to be some of the problem choke points?
Yeah, it's listen, I mean, the Biden administration might, underline the word might, be correct when they point out that in this kind of a situation, it couldn't help but be messy. I don't know. You know, I mean, I can, depending on what hat I want to wear, I can point to the last president and say, hey, the minute he left out the Afghanistan government, in those discussions with the Taliban that he wanted to have at Camp David, the minute he did that, he telegraphed that the United States wasn't going to support the government, thereby freeing all of those troops to go cut their deals with the warlords, which basically said, look, once the Taliban makes their move, you're out of there. You can blame that if you want to, and there are no shortage of people who are doing that. On the other hand, I think it is equally fair to point out, look, you had to know that that was a possibility. And if you have smart people who understand these things, who understand the culture in your administration, they should have known or certainly had a plan to deal with the fact that what happened was going to happen, that the Afghanistan troops were going to split once this process began for the reasons I just said.
Yeah.
They probably should have had a plan for that. They did not. And they certainly should have had a plan to make sure that every single American, and everybody tells me I'm being overbearing when I say every single Afghan who was entitled to an SIV visa should have been out of there. Look, you know, I got to say this. It was the Trump administration who shut down the SIV office. But I didn't see the Biden administration reopening it and reactivating it.
And that's the part that's killing me, Rick. I mean, look, you're totally right there. And it's just, you know, it's why the polls have been somewhat bifurcated in this space, where 60-some percent of the American people are like, yeah, I'm glad we got the hell out of there. But then another 67% are like, dude, could you not
doing it?
Right. Could you have not done this better? And I would, it just, I don't know what that, maybe the historians will be able to break that down for us. I just don't understand how the level of incompetency, to the point you just made, coming in knowing what the prior administration had done to complicate this matter, to take steps to uncomplicate it in the first instance, and then layer out a plan of withdrawal that would be consistent with getting every Afghan loyalist who helped our men and women in uniform, whose families in some cases sheltered and cared for these servicemen and women in some very precarious situations, get them out.
Don't you, though, have to wonder? I mean, look, if you're an American citizen and you're married to an Afghan woman and you've got a family there, I understand how you're not so anxious to leave. I get it. But, you know, with all of the notices that were given to those people of what could be coming, if you were an American citizen in Afghanistan, wouldn't you have been gone months ago?
Yeah, well, that wouldn't have been complicated for me.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like those horror movies, you know. Yeah, right. I'm the guy who's gone. No, nah, we ain't going in that house.
Right. I mean,
there's no need to go in that house.
So many things that attach here that you scratch your head and go, maybe because I haven't been in this situation, I don't fully understand it. But dude, I mean, if I started just reading the news, the minute that I saw the Trump meeting without the Afghanistan government, I'd be going,
I agree with that. But I think part of the answer on that may lie in what those individuals were told on the ground.
Maybe.
What filled their expectation box, you know? Yeah, that there would be a streamlined process. Don't worry, if the shoe comes off here, we're going to be prepared to give you another pair so we can walk you out of here.
I'd have been gone months ago. It's government, man. Come on.
It's government. It's government, and I think it's one of those things now that the Biden administration has taken a huge hit on. And it's like the boxer who suddenly finds himself in the corner and his opponent is starting to land punches. That's the first punch that's landed.
But I got to ask you a question because, you know, I can't help myself.
Sure.
The question is this temporary for Biden or do you think this sticks in any meaningful political way?
Well, we'll get to that because that's going to be how we wrap all of this together, because okay. I think that there is a bow here that either will tie very nicely or will actually wind up strangling the administration. Yeah. And I think that that's something we want to get into. So the first body blow was Afghanistan. The second body blow is, and I want to get your assessment on it, is COVID-19. We've gone through, I can't even begin to estimate the number of iterations of to mask or not to mask, to get a shot or not get a shot, from CDC and other organs inside the government who are sort of laying out these narratives that has given fuel to the right-wing anti-vaxxers, the anti-maskers, and those pandering for them, pandering to them a lot of this noise. How has this COVID narrative changed the course? Remember, this is the administration that came in on the wave of anticipation of opening up the economy. The vaccine protocols were in place. The programming seemed to be there. Yeah, you had some folks out there on the periphery who were kind of being, you know, Trumpist in their views, but by and large, America was on board. What happened?
Well, look, you know, one of the realities of life in America is that when things don't go the way you wish that they would, you blame the president. That's just how we roll in this country. Now, I got to say, I don't think that the president is entitled to one iota of blame for the fact that the Delta variation snuck up and bit us in the nose. But the fact that I don't believe that doesn't really matter. It's definitely having an impact. I'll tell you what I think is even more interesting, though. And those are, look, you know, we've had so many false starts on this. It has become so deeply, deeply politicized that now I think it's actually making things really worse. And I'm going to give you an example that I think is going to surprise you. Ivermectin.
Yeah. Now,
I got turned on to a couple of studies from institutes that I think are very credible. You know, I don't have a life. I actually spend all my time reading this kind of research, right?
Right.
And I started watching the narrative and I went, wait. There might actually be something here, but we're so busy now on the other side, not the right wing, politicizing it that we might miss something here. First of all, yes, ivermectin is typically used as a horse or cattle dewormer. However, when I see people on social media saying it's not for human consumption, well, that's just patently false. Obviously, it's used in different dosages, but ivermectin has been used for a very long time to fight parasitic infections in humans. If your kid comes home from school,
isn't a parasite.
Well, that's a good point. That was obviously my first question. And yet they are finding in some credible studies, I know I'm not convinced yet, but they are finding in some very credible studies that it, son of a gun, it may have a benefit. Now, my point is, no, don't start taking this because a couple of studies say it may have a benefit, because at the same time, you will find studies that say it does not. But there is something here that deserves scientific research. And we ought to get the damn politics out of it and let the scientists research.
But here's the rub. I mean, who put this ivermectin in play in the first place? It didn't come out of the administration.
Came out of Europe.
Came out of what?
Europe.
Yeah. So this is, you know, placed into the ether. Above and beyond the noted authorities who are trying to bird dog the recovery from the health perspective of, okay, what protocols, what process, what medicines, et cetera, we should be using. And it reminds me so much of the crap that Trump was throwing out.
Well, that's the problem. It was Trump who created the ground for all of this, because when he started talking about shooting light up your you-know-what,
right,
and these other things that he was suggesting, well, that's what politicized it. That made it what it is today. The problem is that doesn't mean that there may not be good science behind it.
But that's my point. That good science will come from the good scientists who are working on that. The CDC is not advocating nor promoting this. There are researchers out there that are researching all kinds of shit. That doesn't mean that I'm going to go out and start injecting it into my veins or ingesting it like a, you know,
right, but
like
I gotta
an enema or something.
I got to say this about ivermectin. Some of the research that I've seen, again, I always look at what's the credibility of the institute that's doing it? What was the system that they used? There was one really positive study that came out where we later found out that they had really screwed up.
The process and the results.
So I'm not going to look at that one, but there are others that say to me, no, I'm not sold yet. If I get the illness, I don't know that I'm ready to go to ivermectin, but there is enough out there that everybody should be looking at and saying, all right, this is interesting research. This is not wacko stuff coming from Trump or his followers. There is a basis here. There is an explanation as to why it could work. I've read it. I won't go into it because it's kind of medically weird, but it could work. Now, instead of everybody taking shots at it and saying, well, these people are asking people to swallow horse dewormer. And by the way, if you did just that without knowing the dosage, it's no small wonder that you're going to show up having OD'd on it,
right? But Rick, you're getting to the core point here. Why the hell are you even doing that? Look, I get the internet. I can go on the internet and find all kinds of crazy ass stuff to medicate myself with.
Right.
But I'm not going to do that to avoid COVID. This is my point. Basically, the argument you've just laid out goes to the core of the problem I have. And that is, from the Trump administration to the Bush administration, these health-related organizations have been all over the friggin' map. They have not been clear in their instructions, their timetables, their outcomes. They tell us one moment to do X, then they don't do X anymore, do Y. Oh, well, maybe we don't want you to do Y.
When you're talking about the CDC, that really shouldn't be so surprising. Number one, they're science.
Let me finish the point. This is the point. That when you know that's the situation, it's not surprising that the CDC and other, or you know, Department of Health and others are kind of not haphazardly, but you know, almost like a fit and start, because
the evidence changes.
Right. They're doing the research real time. Right. They're doing research that would take 5, 7, 8 years to do
exactly
in 18 months.
That's exactly right.
Right. So but there's been no one, and I gave up on this in the Trump administration because of Trump and the way he approached all of this, where the real scientists and ethical leaders involved in the conversation were sort of dismissed. I am surprised that the Biden administration has not had a better handle on the COVID narrative, such that you come in riding this wave of confidence that the voters have, that finally a grown-up is going to be telling us what to do. And at the end of the day, as we just started this conversation, we're talking about taking horse dewormers. And that's the problem here, is that no one seems to have a handle on it.
I'm not going to make light of that simply because there is some research. Now, I'm going to agree with you and say, just because there's some positive research doesn't mean everybody rush and start swallowing ivermectin.
But that research is not coming from the authority that's telling us what to do
COVID. I don't even know if they're doing any. And that's a fair point. That is a fair point. I don't know. I guess where I'm trying to get to here is we would all be doing ourselves a big, big favor. And I have a very self-serving, as you know, reason to say that. I am somebody who is not protected by the vaccine. It doesn't work on me for a number of reasons.
Right.
So I keep a very sharp eye out as I prepare myself for the possibility that I could get it. And I'm an old guy with pre-existing conditions. Right. And I have to say, of all the wacko stuff that's come down the pike, most of it, it's been very easy for me to say, well, that's nonsense, because I could go to the studies. Ivermectin might turn out.
Yeah, but you're not taking ivermectin, Rick Unger, unless and until either A, the CDC tells you to,
that's
or
right.
B, your doctor advises you to.
That's right.
All right. So you can research the hell out of anything. The reality of it is,
all I'm trying to say is, let's not squelch something at the early.
Well, I can squelch it because I'm not a scientist, right? I can say, but this is your point, I guess. Having people out here bad mouthing something that may ultimately be a help is not helpful.
Right.
But that's my point. No one has control over the messaging around the medications and the protocols that are going to be beneficial to people right now. I don't care about research that may come in 6 months. I care about, what do I need to do? You, as an elderly individual with pre-existing conditions where the vaccine is not going to be helpful to you.
I'm allowed to say I'm elderly. You're not.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry about that. Oh, well, okay. So as an old man who has pre-existing... but you know, so your motivations are going to be different from mine, number one. That's why it's important to have intelligent narratives.
Yes, I agree.
For both of us. And why don't we have that right now? We can point back and go, Trump really kind of screwed the pooch in coming out of the gates the way we have. But that's not the situation now.
And you know, I'm not interested in blame anymore. I'm interested in scientific results.
Right.
So, okay. Yeah, that's exactly right. And there are 10 million other people just in this country who are in a similar circumstance that I am. And you can believe that they're paying real attention to this stuff, no matter what their politics might be. So, you know, I guess the point I'm making is everybody ought to shut up and back off and let this science happen, because it could end up saving your life or somebody's life that you care about. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of all the politicization. I'm tired of the politicization over face masks. That's something that should be a no-brainer. This whole freedom argument is just so stupid. I can't believe that this is where we ended up. And I don't care what your politics are. It's stupid. It's just stupid.
We're driving down and digesting on some of the big big issues that the current administration is facing, and trying to understand why the hell it's playing out the way it is in some cases with our good friend Rick Unger. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, it's going to get gnarly. We'll be right back after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Michael Steele, and we're having a wonderful conversation with my buddy Rick Unger, the host of the Rick Unger Show, nationally syndicated. You can catch him every day on the air in local markets. So, Rick, Texas. What the hell do we do about Texas? So here's the deal. The United States Supreme Court, in its incredible, I won't say wisdom. I don't know what the hell they were thinking. Allowed a new law to go into effect in Texas that bans abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy at a point where, as and I know people are tired of hearing this, but it's important to note, most women don't even realize they are pregnant when they are 6 weeks pregnant. And the law allows also private citizens to sue abortion providers and anyone else who helps a woman obtain an abortion, including those who would give the woman a ride. So that's Uber, your local taxi cab company, your car service company, to a clinic, or to provide any type of financial assistance to obtain an abortion. Private citizens are now stepping in the shoes of the state to bring these lawsuits. They don't have to show any connection, people, to the individuals they're suing. So let me put it to you in this way. It would be as if Rick Unger committed an act that I did not like, and I sued Rick Unger. The act had no impact on me personally. I was made aware of it through various means. I may have seen it or I was told about it. And I'm then bringing a lawsuit against Rick. It is that disconnected. This, as I say this as someone who is a pro-life Roman Catholic, this is an abomination. What the state of Texas is doing to women. And this is not helping the fetus, because if a fetus is in a distressful situation or puts the mother in a distressed situation, what are the outcomes here? What are the options? If some third party does not like the choice you make, decides to step in. This law bans abortions as soon as its cardiac activity is detectable. It's different from what we see, Rick, in other states because of what it allows citizens to do versus what the state is allowed to do. And we're already beginning to see other states up to seven now, mostly red states. I hate putting it in that term, but, you know, Republican states, governors, legislators who are already looking at ways to copycat the Texas law. So before we get into some of the politics of this, Rick, you've always been, because you're a lawyer, you're a former judge. I want to bring your legal expertise to this first. Help us understand what this means and why the Supreme Court did this the way they did, largely on a procedural move as opposed to actually dealing with the merits.
Well, you have to, again, divide that into two parts. You know, the first part is you just highlighted it. They did it based on a procedural argument that there was no plaintiff available who had been affected by the law. Therefore, nobody had standing as of yet to push for this stay. That is a really fallacious argument. When you are trying to stop a law from going into effect, the notion that you have to have already been hurt by it is absolute nonsense. That's not how you gain standing, and the Supreme Court knows that better than I do. It's fascinating. At the end of the day, and this maybe speaks more to the second point, when you do finally get a case coming out of Texas having to do with this law, and that hasn't happened yet because I am unaware of anybody who has brought a cause of action seeking that $10,000 or more. But when that eventually happens, there's a couple of things that I think you can anticipate. Number one, now you've got a case that the Supreme Court can decide whether or not that law was unconstitutional. It clearly is, and they knew it when they refused to impose the stay. So that's number one. But number two, there's something that's going to happen in between that is not getting enough conversation. There are two sections of the federal criminal code, sections, I think, 241 and 242, that actually say if you deny somebody their constitutional rights, even under color of law, even under color of law, a state has told you you can do it. And this was all passed, by the way, originally to deal with the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
If that happens, you can be held criminally liable. So what's going to happen here first is somebody's going to do it, and they're going to basically be ratting themselves out when they go to a court and say, hey, I am busting these following people for participating in an abortion, right? So you're going to have the opportunity for the Justice Department to jump on it. But you know what's going to happen when the Supreme Court finally hears this case? They are going to shoot down this case because this is not the case that they're going to use to destroy Roe v. Wade.
It's the Mississippi case.
The Mississippi case.
Yeah.
So, you know, many
would... Could you tell folks a little bit about that case?
Well, the only real... it takes a much more normal approach, if you will. It is far more conservative in the impact. I think it says you can't have an abortion after 14 or 15 weeks, right, which is still short of the time we consider to be a viable fetus.
Which is, I think, 21, 22, something like that?
That's about 21, 22. The other part, and this was a major flaw in the Texas legislation, they based the whole thing of when you could have abortion based on finding a heart rhythm, right? Well, guess what? There is no heart at the point when you start hearing electronic indications, right? There's no heart that's been formed yet. It is the area where there's going to be a heart. But even that was a misnomer. There's just so much wrong with it. It's unbelievable. Mississippi, though, is the perfect case for the court to do what we know that the majority wants to do. And that's where Roe v. Wade's going to come to an end. I think by allowing this thing to go forward, they were just preparing the ground. They were softening up the turf for what's about to come with the Mississippi case. And the funny part is the Mississippi case will probably be heard before a Texas case can actually get to them. And it's been stayed anyhow right now by a local judge, the Texas situation. So it's going to be Mississippi that's going to tell all of us what the Supreme Court is going to do. And if I had to bet, I'd say that they're going to use that case to do away with what they have always thought. And I know you also think, and I understand why, is bad law in Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, I've always contended that that Roe was wrongly decided and prematurely decided, and the states were never really given the opportunity, as we've seen in other areas of our culture and our economy and our politics that touch on the Constitution, given the chance to work out amongst themselves where they stand. And then you'd have this patchwork of laws that the Supreme Court would then begin to formulate what the constitutional ramifications and impacts are. The question here for Roe, and I understand the Mississippi case, and this is the other part of the question that I have for you, is you know, based on this right to privacy, which to me is not found in the Constitution, it's made up law, in my view. That's a host of cases, starting with Griswold and others. How does that begin to unravel as well, the privacy question? Because if you're saying to me, if this court's saying that the Mississippi case is one that allows for the overturn, and it's specifically in the Mississippi case, is the question is whether all pre-viability prohibitions on elective abortions are unconstitutional, and it gets into a lot of the nuance and straight up analysis that we have not seen in other cases. How does this touch on that question of privacy? How do you undo Roe and still say that a woman has a right to privately decide what to do with her own body?
Yeah, it's a great question, and a question that I would say is at the very heart of it. Because, I mean, what you've said, and I haven't agreed with you necessarily, but I've always understood the argument, and I think that the Supreme Court will likely use the very argument you've been making for a long time. And that is to basically say, sorry, I've read the Constitution, I can interpret the Constitution broadly, and you know, I just can't find that right of privacy that Roe v. Wade relied upon. I get that. I do. I don't know that there is a constitutional right of privacy. So that is that, you know, that's always been at the heart of those who think that Roe v. Wade was improperly decided. It was a very broad interpretation of the Constitution. I'm not going to deny that because there's no point to denying it. That's the reality. It still has been the law for a long time. Now, does that basically say to us that there are no other rights of privacy granted by the Constitution? Probably, because if you believe that the Constitution deal with it, then it doesn't deal with it. That doesn't mean that we are not capable of creating laws that do deal with privacy. And by the way, the place where it always should have been done and still should be done is in the legislative branch, not only of the United States, but of each and every state. Each and every state is going to deal with it. After the Supreme Court has their say on this, then you will find the states getting busy. Red states will make it impossible to get abortion. Blue states will deal with it, if they haven't already legislatively, to make it more possible. At the federal government level, you and I both know that if Congress wanted to resolve this, it's very simple.
They codify Roe.
You codify Roe, but yeah, they can't do it because they don't have the votes. And there have been times when they did have the votes and they did not do it. So you know what? If Roe v. Wade goes away, you can't just blame the United States Supreme Court in its present configuration. You also have to blame those periods of time when Democrats had the White House, Democrats had unassailable majorities, even in the Senate, where a filibuster couldn't stop it, and they never used that to codify Roe.
No, and it goes, so this kind of moves us into the political part of this discussion, which, of course, animates all of this discussion in so many ways. The Democrats have never understood what Republicans realized going back to the 1980s. So the very first moment the party decided to embrace a pro-life plank in its platform, in the 1980 platform, with Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, who was pro-choice himself, embraced that and eventually kind of moved into that space, because the undercurrent, the underlying undercurrent, was there. I was looking at some very interesting political analysis around the Roe decision, and the use of Roe politically by the right had less to do with the fetus and the viability of life, and more to do with the politics of race. And I really thought that was fascinating, that a lot of this was sort of a way to, in the first instance, create an appeal for white suburban women who were concerned about you know, this issue relative to their daughters and so forth and themselves to some extent, but also coming out of the Planned Parenthood and the history of Planned Parenthood in the Black community. There were, you know, political cynics on the right saw an opportunity to sort of create this kind of a wedge. So you have all these dynamics, Rick, that are in play. You have the Justice Department now, with Attorney General Merrick Garland, saying that all options are going to be on the table to challenge this law. The president himself has been sharply critical of it. But here's something I find to be interesting, and from a political standpoint, my friends on the right, those hardcore conservatives at Fox and in print and elsewhere, have been conspicuously silent. In fact, when this story broke, Fox News basically paid little attention to it. What do you think is going on there from the right? I've heard different analysis that some on the right are concerned that they've actually may have outfoxed themselves here.
And that's what's going on there.
What's your analysis on that?
Exactly that. I know a lot of Republicans who are not happy with what the Supreme Court did, because you were facing a midterm next year where every possible advantage you can imagine is working for the Republicans, whether it's the current year of gerrymandering, the changes in voting laws. I mean, it would take a miracle for Democrats to hold on to a majority in the House and maybe even in the Senate. Well, this could be that kind of a miracle, because there's nothing like a bedrock cultural issue to get people out to vote. And that is why Fox is keeping quiet about it. They recognize that even with their conservative audience, there are people who feel that it should be a woman's right to make this choice. Even if they're like me, I am not a fan of abortion. I wouldn't do it. But I don't get to tell somebody else what to do with their body, not only because I'm a man and really totally can't relate to the issues, right, but because as a human, I don't feel I get to tell people what to do. It's up for them to decide. If they're doing something wrong, that's between them and their God. I don't get to make that decision for them. So there are a lot of people watching Fox, I think, who feel the same way.
Yeah, I think to your point, Politico happens to agree with you. They put out a piece on the heels just a few days ago, on the heels of this story breaking, noting that, quote, suddenly stories that weren't great political terrain for Biden and Democrats, the fallout from the Afghanistan pullout, the new Delta surge, humdrum new unemployment numbers, some of which we already talked about, were replaced by the Texas news. Then the Supreme Court non-ruling, a storyline that Democrats know will motivate their liberal base and potentially drive moderate women, particularly independent women, to the polls. And that's giving Democrats big hopes, both in upcoming elections and for 2022. They can use what's happening in other states, those seven states that I referred to before that are now looking at mimicking the Texas law, you know, Alabama, Mississippi, et cetera, and the judiciary's non-intervention are now ways in which they can nationalize their campaigns. And the first example of that we have, of course, Rick, is in the upcoming recall of Governor Gavin Newsom in California, who is now making abortion rights a central theme in his campaign to hold on to a seat in California.
And numbers skyrocket.
Yeah, he's now plus 11 for retention.
And it was neck and neck.
Now,
that's it. Now, I got to tell you, what's fascinating about everything you just read is that I am convinced, as much as some people might be ticked off at the president right now over the Afghanistan withdrawal, that will be a distant memory by the midterms.
Unless
something really horrible happens with some Americans who aren't out yet. That will be a distant memory. This doesn't go away, especially if the Supreme Court ends up using Mississippi to either eradicate Roe v. Wade and Casey or to make significant dents.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think of all the issues that, you know, we've touched on in this sort of digestion that we've been doing, first on Afghanistan, then on COVID, now on Texas. I think the Afghan piece fades unless there is a terrorist attack, God forbid, or some other nexus back to Afghanistan that stimulates the public's psyche on that subject. I think, though, this issue, particularly with Mississippi coming in the fall with a decision to be made in June, by June of next year. If I'm a Republican, I kind of go back to your analysis and what you've heard from other Republicans, and I've heard some of it as well. They're not sitting there going, yippee, we got an issue. You know, as much as their base may be stimulated to come out for whatever Trumpian or other reasons they may have, certainly related to abortion, you're not going to tell me that the Democratic base is going to be equally stimulated. And the difference is that this issue pulls more in terms of independent voters than, you know, for supporters. The national polling has shown, the country is showing, that Americans largely have your view, and that is, and which is mine too, as a pro-lifer, I don't get to tell a woman she can't abort her child, right? My responsibility as a Christian is to walk with her through that, show her what alternatives are there for her and that baby, but God gave her free will. And I don't get to step in between God and her on that. And that goes even beyond her doctor, right? Because even her doctor may be advising her to do something where her free will may take her someplace else. That's the complexity of this issue. And there's no government, Rick, that's going to write that law that's going to change that. And so we need to be mindful of these things, I think. And from a political standpoint, it's problematic for Republicans. And there are a lot of nervous Republicans right now seeing this issue take off the table, a real opportunity to take the House and the Senate around issues of economy and health care. But now abortion, which is for a lot of women the ultimate health care issue, could be a different scenario. What say you?
That I say good.
As I know you would.
This is just not a time for Republicans. I'm sorry. I think we're going to get stuck with a Republican majority in Congress and probably even in the Senate next year. It's very bad timing in my view. And look, I mean, you know, even if you're of the point of view that maybe the current president is overdoing it on some of the social programs and this and that, even if that's your point of view, it's a very bad time for Republicans, not Republicans like you, but Republicans like millions of people who still see Donald Trump as the savior. This is not a good time for them to be in power.
So you've brought out the bow. So for us to sort of wrap up this conversation around these big three issues that seemingly have undermined the momentum of, at least in two instances, undermined the momentum of the Biden administration, set up a negative narrative going into this fall and certainly next year's midterm elections. The third issue, the Texas abortion law with the ancillary Mississippi abortion law to come, seemingly could pull back some of that loss and reorient the way people are kind of looking at and evaluating Republicans and Democrats, the role of government versus a non-role for government. How are you tying this bow right now when you're looking at these issues? Do you see the president getting to higher ground on COVID, certainly higher ground on Afghanistan, certainly has the highest ground right now with this issue because it's right in his wheelhouse, on the abortion questions? How do you see that bow being tied, or does he wind up strangling himself and Democrats with it?
Well, I, as you say, he's already at higher ground on this abortion issue. I think he probably does get to higher ground by the next presidential election on COVID. I just think that by that time, we're going to have gotten it more under control. But then again, we've said that before, so I've got to be mindful of that. If we haven't gotten it more under control, he's going to be on even lower ground. And I'm not sure that'll be fair, but it won't matter that I don't think it's fair. It's going to be. The other piece of it is, Afghanistan, I think, again, barring anything happening, a terrorist attack, as you suggested, Americans not making it home or worse, being killed, I think that this is not going to end up being a big issue in either the midterms or the presidential election. And I think there's one more thing you got to throw into that, and that is, who is the Republican nominee? Because if it is Donald Trump, I think all of these issues will go out the window. It'll be an entirely different presidential based on different things.
How are you assessing going into, you've got two big races in Virginia where Terry McAuliffe and Youngkin are head-to-head. McAuliffe seems to have been pulling ahead of Youngkin, who at some point had drawn to even. And I think in a few polls I saw was up by 1 or 2 points, but now it's fallen back. You've got New Jersey governor's race, which is another big race. But then that sort of swings us into the nomination process, the kinds of candidates that will be emerging in the 22 cycle for every office from governor to members of Congress in the U.S. Senate, and certainly state legislatures as well. What's your assessment, prognostication at this point for, you've already alluded to Republicans taking control of the House and Senate? I'm still kind of iffy on that. I'm not necessarily buying into the traditional narrative that, off-year cycles for the president in power, he takes a hit. I think we've seen that change a little bit over time. But how are you seeing things so far?
Well, I think the Virginia governor's race is interesting, and I do think that McAuliffe will end up winning it. And I think it could be symptomatic of some other things we're going to see. Look, here's the reality. People don't love McAuliffe, right? I mean, I think they may have liked him as a governor.
He's a fairly good governor for what I hear from a lot of Virginians,
But they don't like him. And they don't like him because they perceive him the way I've always perceived him as a Democrat. I think he's kind of a sleaze. I'm just going to say it. Any guy that is taking his wife home from the hospital with her newborn baby, stops at a fundraiser and leaves his wife and baby in the car for an hour or two, I'm not okay with him. I think he's a jerk. I think he's But when it comes down to the actual vote and people say, do I want a Democrat like McAuliffe, even though I think he's a low character guy, or do I want a Trump supporting kind of a guy? I think Virginia will go for the Democrat. And that's probably going to happen in a lot of races, depending on a lot of things. And by the way, I think that's what will happen in the next presidential race, because I think that Trump is going to run. And I think he'll get beat again.
Well, you have given us a lot to think about, my friend. I just love when we get to mash down on stuff like this and just kind of grind it out a little bit and sort of figure out where the nuances and the corners and the edges are. And yeah, it's just, you know, Steel and Unger. It's just a great combo for stuff like this. Yeah, I really love it.
With that, Steel and Unger.
We should do a radio show.
What a great idea.
Rick Unger, he is the host of the Rick Unger Show. You catch him nationally, folks. He's syndicated, so you can find him pretty much in every major market in the country. It's 2 hours of political and news commentary. He is a progressive, at least on paper. But I love him because he's like a brother from another mother. We connect on so many levels. And while we don't see everything eye to eye, we see it clearly enough that we can have the conversation. And I hope that's what you picked up today. You learned a little bit, thought about some things a little bit differently, because that's what Unger brings. He hates to be called Unger, so I just had to throw that out there.
If my mother wanted to call me
Unger, he would have named Unger. I know. But that's what Rick brings to the table, and I'm so glad you could bring it for our conversation today, Rick.
Always
thanks a lot.
My man. Pleasure.
Thank you so much. All right, that does it for our time together for this week, at least. We'll be back, as always, with some interesting convo. So glad when you're able to do that thing you do. We call it the voodoo of the download, baby. Give us that 5-star review as well. Share us on your social media. You can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. But definitely get the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll appreciate you. Until next time, be safe, be well, get the vaccine, wear the mask, protect you and your family because you love them, right? Because that's what we do for the people we love. And until then, be good. All right, that does it. Later.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is
Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short.
Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.